got a grip on her backpack, and of course she could have wriggled out of it and got away. But Granny's letter to the monster was inside, so she turned round and fought. As usual, she tried to shield her face so Mum wouldn't get upset when she saw the damage, but it wasn't possible to shield both her face and the backpack, so things took their course.
"You should choose your battles if you can, but if the battle chooses you, then you kick the sod in his fuse box,"
Granny used to tell Elsa. And that is what Elsa did. Even though she hates violence, she's good at fighting because she's had a lot of practice. That's why there are so many of them now when they chase her. Mum comes out of the headmaster's office after at least 10 eternities of fairy tales. And then they cross the deserted playground without saying anything. Elsa gets into the back seat of Kia with her arms round her backpack. Mum looks unhappy. "Please, Elsa."
"It wasn't me that started it. He said girls can't be Spider-Man."
"Yes, but why do you fight?"
"Just because."
"You're not a little kid, Elsa. You always say I should treat you like a grown-up, so stop answering me like a little kid. Why do you fight?" Elsa pokes at the rubber seal in the door.
"Because I'm tired of running."
And then Mum tries to reach into the back and caress her gently across her scratch marks, but Elsa snatches her head away. "I don't know what to do," Mum sighs, holding back her tears.
"You don't have to do anything,"
Elsa mumbles. Mum backs Kia out of the parking area and drives off. They sit there in the sort of silent eternity that only mothers and daughters can build up between themselves. "Maybe we should go to a psychologist after all," she says at last. Elsa shrugs.
"Whatever."
That's her second favourite word in English. "Elsa, darling, I know what's happened with Granny has hit you terribly hard. Death is hard for everyone."
"You don't know anything,"
Elsa interrupts and pulls so hard at the rubber seal that when she lets go, it snaps back against the window with a loud noise. "I'm sad as well, Elsa," says Mum, swallowing. "She was my mother, not just your grandmother."
"You hated her, so don't talk rubbish."
"I did not hate her. She was my mother."
"You were always fighting. You're probably just glad she's dead."
Elsa wishes she never said that last bit, but it's too late. There's a silence, lasting for all imaginable eternities, and she pokes at the rubber seal until its edge comes away from the door. Mum notices, but she doesn't say anything. When they stop at a red light, she puts her hand over her eyes and says resignedly, "I'm really trying here, Elsa, really trying. I know I'm a bad mother and I'm not at home enough, but I'm really trying." Elsa doesn't answer. Mum massages her temples. "Maybe we should talk to a psychologist anyway."
"You talk to a psychologist,"
says Elsa. "Yeah, maybe I should."
"Yeah, maybe you should."
"Why are you so horrible?"
"Why are you so horrible?"
"Darling, I'm really sad about Granny dying, but we have to..."
"No, you're not."
And then something happens that hardly ever, ever happens. Mum loses her composure and yells, "Yes, I bloody am! Try to understand that you're not the only one who's capable of being upset and stop being such a little brat!" Mum and Elsa stare at each other. Mum covers her mouth with her hand. "Elsa, darling..." Elsa shakes her head and pulls off the entire rubber seal from the door in a single tug. She knows she's won. When Mum loses control, Elsa wins every time.
"Cut it out. It's not good shouting like that," she mumbles,
and then she adds without so much as glancing at her mother,
"Think about the baby."
Chapter 7. Leather. It's possible to love your grandmother for years and years without really knowing anything about her. It's Tuesday when Elsa meets the monster for the first time. School is better on Tuesdays. Elsa only has one bruise today, and bruises can be explained away by saying she's been playing football. She sits in Audi. Audi is Dad's car. It's the exact opposite of Renault. Normally Dad picks her up from school every other Friday because that's when she stays with Dad and Lisette's children. Granny used to pick her up on all the other days, and now Mum will have to do it. But today Mum and George have gone to a doctor to look at Harvey, so today Dad is picking her up, even though it's a Tuesday. Granny always came on time and stood at the gate. Dad is late and stays in the Audi in the parking area. "What did you do to your eye?" Dad asks insecurely. He came back from Spain this morning because he went there with Lisette and Lisette's children, but he hasn't caught the sun because he doesn't know how to. "We played football," says Elsa. Granny would never have let her get away with the football story, but Dad isn't Granny, so he just nods tentatively and asks her to be good enough to put on her seatbelt. He does that very often. Nods, tentatively. Dad is a tentative person. Mum is a perfectionist and Dad is a pedant, and that was partly why their marriage didn't work so well, Elsa figures. Because a perfectionist and a pedant are two very different things. When Mum and Dad did the cleaning, Mum wrote a minute-by-minute breakdown of the cleaning schedule, but then Dad would sort of get caught up with descaling the coffee percolator for 2.5 hours, and you really can't plan a life with a person like that around you, said Mum. The teachers at school always tell Elsa that her problem is her inability to concentrate, which is very odd, Elsa thinks, because Dad's big problem is that he can't stop concentrating. "So, what do you want to do?" asks Dad, indecisively putting his hands on the wheel. He often does that, asks what Elsa would like to do, because he very rarely wants to do anything himself. And this Tuesday was very unexpected for him. Dad is not very good at dealing with unexpected Tuesdays. That's why Elsa only stays every other weekend with him, because after he met Lisette and she and her children moved in, Dad said it was too messy for Elsa there. When Granny found out, she phoned him and called him a Nazi at least 10 times in a minute. That was a Nazi record, even for Granny. And when she'd hung up, she turned to Elsa and spluttered, "Lisette, what sort of name is that?" And Elsa knew she didn't really mean it, of course, because everyone likes Lisette. She has the same superpower as George. But Granny was the sort of person you brought with you when you went to war, and that was what Elsa loved about her. Dad's always late picking Elsa up from school. Granny was never late. Elsa has tried to understand exactly what irony means, and she's fairly sure it's that Dad is never late for anything other than picking up Elsa from school, and Granny was always late for everything except for that one thing. Dad fiddles with the wheel again. "So, where would you like to go today?" Elsa looks surprised, because it sounds as if he really means they're going somewhere. He twists in his seat. "I was thinking maybe you'd like to do something." Elsa knows he's only saying it to be nice, because Dad doesn't like doing things. Dad is not a doing type of person. Elsa looks at him. He looks at the steering wheel. "I think I'd just like to go home," she says. Dad nods and looks disappointed and relieved at the same time, which is a facial expression that only he in the whole world has mastered. Because Dad never says no to Elsa, even though she sometimes wishes he would. "Audi is really nice," she says when they're halfway home and neither of them has said a word. She pats the glove compartment of Audi as if it was a cat. New cars smell of soft leather, the polar opposite of the smell of old split leather in Granny's flat. Elsa likes both smells, though she prefers living animals to dead ones that have been made into car seats. "You know what you're getting with an Audi," Dad says, nodding. His last car was also called Audi. Dad likes to know what he's getting. One time last year, they rearranged the shelves in the supermarket near to where Dad and Lisette live, and Elsa had to run those tests she'd seen advertised on the television to make sure he hadn't had a stroke. Once they get home, Dad gets out of Audi and goes with her to the entrance. Britt Marie is on the other side of the door, hunched up like a livid little house pixie on guard. It occurs to Elsa that you always know no good can come of catching sight of Britt Marie. "She's like a letter from the tax authorities, that old biddy," Granny used to say. Dad seems to agree because Britt Marie is one of the few subjects on which he and Granny were in agreement. She's holding a crossword magazine in her hand. Brit Marie likes crosswords very much because there are very clear rules about how to do them. She only ever does them in pencil, though. Granny always said Brit Marie was the sort of woman who would have to drink 2 glasses of wine and feel really wild and crazy to be able to fantasize about solving a crossword in ink. Dad offers a tentative hello, but Brit Marie interrupts him.
"Do you know whose this is?"
she says, pointing at a pram, padlocked to the stair railing under the notice board. Only now does Elsa notice it. It's odd that it should be there at all, because there are no babies in the house except Harfy, and he still gets a lift everywhere with Mum. But Brit Marie seems unable to attach any value to this deeper philosophical question.
"Prams are not allowed in the entrance vestibule. They're a fire risk," she declares, firmly clasping her hands together so that the crossword magazine sticks out like a rather feeble sword.
"Yes, it says on the notice here," says Elsa,
nodding helpfully and pointing at a neatly written sign right above the pram, on which it is written,
"Do not leave prams here. They are a fire risk."
"That's what I mean,"
Brit Marie replies with a slightly raised but still well-meaning voice.
"I don't understand," says Dad, as if he doesn't understand.
"I am obviously wondering if you put this sign up. That's what I'm wondering," says Brit Marie, taking a small step forward and then a very small step back, as if to emphasize the gravity of this.
"Is there something wrong with the notice?" asks Elsa.
"Of course not, of course not. But it's not common practice in this leaseholders' association to simply put up signs in any old way without first clearing it with the other residents in the house."
"But there is no leaseholders' association, is there?" asks Elsa.
"No, but there's going to be, and until there is, I'm in charge of information in the association committee. It's not common practice to put up signs without notifying the head of information of the association committee."
She's interrupted by the bark of a dog, so loud that it rattles a pane of glass in the door. They all jump. Yesterday, Elsa heard Mum telling George that Brit Marie had called the police to say that our friend should be put down. It seems to have heard Brit Marie's voice now, and just like Granny, our friend can't shut up for a second when that happens. Brit Marie starts ranting about how that dog needs to be dealt with. Dad just looks uncomfortable.
"Maybe someone tried to tell you, but you weren't home," Elsa suggests to Brit Marie, pointing at the sign on the wall.
It works, at least temporarily. Brit Marie forgets to be upset about our friend when she gets re-upset by the sign, because the most important thing for her is not to run out of things to be upset about. Elsa briefly considers telling Brit Marie to put up a sign letting the neighbours know that if they want to put up a notice, they have to inform their neighbours first, for instance by putting up a notice. The dog barks again from the flat a half stare up. Brit Marie purses her mouth.
"I've called the police, I have. But of course they won't do anything. They say we have to wait until tomorrow to see if the owner turns up."
Dad doesn't answer, and Brit Marie immediately interprets his silence as a sign that he'd love to hear more about Brit Marie's feelings on the topic.
"Kent has rung on the door of that flat lots of times, but no one even lives there, as if that wild animal lives there on its own. Would you believe it?"
Elsa holds her breath, but no more barking can be heard, as if our friend has summoned some common sense at last. The entrance door behind Dad opens and the woman in the black skirt comes in. Her heels click against the floor and she's talking loudly into the white lead attached to her ear.
"Hello,"
says Elsa, to deflect Brit Marie's attention from any further barking.
"Hello," says Dad, to be polite.
Well, hello there,"
says Brit Marie, as if the woman is potentially a criminal bill poster. The woman doesn't answer. She just talks even louder into the white cable, gives all three of them an irritated look, and disappears up the stairs. There's a long, strained silence in the stairwell after she has gone. Elsa's dad is not so good at dealing with strained silences.
"Helvetica," he manages to say in the middle of a nervous bout of throat clearing.
"Pardon me?"
says Brit Marie and purses her mouth even harder.
"Helvetica, the font, I mean,"
says Dad, skittishly, nodding at the sign on the wall.
"It's a good font."
Fonts are the sort of thing Dad finds important. One time when Mum was at a parents' evening at Elsa's school, and Dad had called at the very last possible moment to say he couldn't make it because of something that had come up at work, Mum, as a punishment, signed him up as a volunteer to do the posters for the school's jumble sale. Dad looked very doubtful about it when he found out. It took him 3 weeks to decide what sort of font the posters should have. When he brought them into school, Elsa's teacher didn't want to put them up because they'd already had the jumble sale, but Elsa's father had apparently not understood what this had to do with it. It's a little like Britt Marie not really comprehending what the Helvetica font has to do with anything at all right now. Dad looks down at the floor and clears his throat again.
"Do you have keys?" he asks Elsa.
She nods. They hug, briefly. Relieved, Dad disappears out of the door and Elsa darts up the stairs before Britt Marie has time to start talking to her again. Outside our friend's flat, she stops briefly, peers back over her shoulder to make sure Britt Marie is not watching, then opens the letterbox to whisper,
"Please, be quiet."
She knows that it understands. She hopes that it cares. She runs up the last flight of stairs with the keys to the flat in her hand, but she doesn't go into Mum and George's flat. Instead, she opens Granny's door. There are storage boxes and a scouring bucket in the kitchen. She tries not to pay any attention to those, but fails. She hops into the big wardrobe. The darkness inside the wardrobe settles around her, and no one knows she's crying. It used to be magic, this wardrobe. Elsa used to be able to lie full length in it, and only just reach the walls with her toes and fingertips. However much she grew, the wardrobe was exactly the right size. Granny maintained, of course, that it was all faffing about because this wardrobe has always been exactly the same size. But Elsa has measured it, so she knows. She lies down, stretching herself as far as she can, touching both walls. In a few months, she won't have to reach. In a year, she won't be able to lie here at all, because nothing will be magic anymore. She can hear Maud and Leonard's muted voices in the flat, can smell their coffee. Elsa knows Samantha is also there long before she hears the sound of the Bichon Frise's paws in the living room, and shortly after, it's snoring under Granny's sofa table. Maud and Leonard are tidying up Granny's flat and starting to pack up her things. Mum has asked them to help, and Elsa hates Mum for that, hates everyone for it. Soon, she hears Britt Marie's voice as well, as if she's pursuing Maud and Leonard. She's very angry, only wants to talk about who's had the cheek to put up that sign in the vestibule and who's been impudent enough to lock up that pram directly under the sign. It seems very unclear, also to Britt Marie herself, which of these two occurrences is the most upsetting to her, but at least she doesn't mention our friend again. Elsa has been in the wardrobe for an hour when the boy with the syndrome comes crawling in. Through the half-open door, Elsa sees his mother walking about, tidying, and how Maud carefully walks behind her, picking up the things that are falling all around her. Leonard puts a big platter of dreams outside the wardrobe. Elsa pulls them inside and closes the door, and then she and the boy with the syndrome eat them in silence. The boy doesn't say anything because he never does. That is one of Elsa's favourite things about him. She hears George's voice in the kitchen. It's warm and reassuring. It asks if anyone wants eggs, because in that case he'll cook eggs. Everyone likes George. It's his superpower. Elsa hates him for that. Then Elsa hears her mum's voice, and for a moment she wants to run out and throw herself into her arms. But she doesn't, because she wants her mother to be upset. Elsa knows she has already won, but she wants Mum to know it too, just to make sure she's hurting as much as Elsa is about Granny dying. The boy falls asleep at the bottom of the wardrobe. His mother gently opens the door soon after and crawls inside and lifts him out. It's as if she knew he had fallen asleep the minute he did. Maybe that's her superpower. Moments later, Maud crawls inside and carefully picks up all the things the boy's mother dropped when she was picking him up.
"Thanks for the biscuits,"
whispers Elsa. Maud pats her on the cheek and looks so upset on Elsa's behalf that Elsa gets upset on Maud's behalf. She stays in the wardrobe until everyone has stopped tidying and stopped packing and gone back to their own flats. She knows that Mum is sitting in the hall of their flat, waiting for her, so she sits in the big deep window on the stairs for a long time, to ensure that Mum has to keep waiting. She sits there until the lights in the stairwell automatically switch off. After a while, the drunk comes stumbling out of a flat further down in the house and starts hitting the banister with her shoehorn and mumbling something about how people aren't allowed to take baths at night. The drunk does this a few times every week. There's nothing abnormal about it. "Turn off the water," mutters the drunk. But Elsa doesn't answer. Nor does anyone else, because people in houses like this seem to believe that drunks are like monsters, and if one pretends they are not there, they actually disappear. Elsa hears how the drunk, in a passionate exhortation for water rationing, slips and falls and ends up on her arse, with the shoehorn falling on her head. The drunk and the shoehorn have a fairly long drawn-out dispute after that, like two old friends at loggerheads about money. And then at last there's silence. And then Elsa hears the song the drunk always sings. Elsa sits in the darkness on the stairs and hugs herself, as if it was a lullaby just for her. And then, even that falls silent, she hears the drunk trying to calm down the shoehorn before disappearing into her flat again. Elsa half closes her eyes, tries to see the cloud animals and the first outlying fields of the land of almost awake, but it doesn't work. She can't get there anymore. Not without Granny. She opens her eyes, absolutely inconsolable. The snowflakes fall like wet mittens against the window. And that's when she sees the monster for the first time. It's one of those winter nights when the darkness is so thick, it's as if the whole area has been dipped headfirst in a bucket of blackness, and the monster steals out of the door and crosses the half-circle of light around the last light in the street so quickly that if Elsa had blinked a little too hard, she would have thought she was imagining it. But as it is, she knows what she saw, and she hits the floor and makes her way down the stairs in one fluid movement. She's never seen him before. But she knows from his sheer size that it must be him. He glides across the snow like an animal, a beast from one of Granny's fairy tales. Elsa knows very well that what she's about to do is both dangerous and idiotic, but she runs down the stairs, three steps at a time. Her socks slip on the last step, and she careers across the ground floor vestibule, smacking her chin into the door handle. Her face throbbing with pain, she throws the door open and breathlessly churns through the snow, still only in her socks. I have post for you, she cries, into the night. Only then does she realize that her tears have lodged in her throat. She's so desperate to know who this person is that Granny secretly talked to about Miamis. There's no answer. She hears his light footfalls in the snow. Surprisingly agile considering his enormity, he's moving away from her. Elsa ought to be afraid. She should be terrified of what the monster could do to her. He's big enough to tear her apart with a single tug. She knows that. But she's too angry to be afraid. My granny sends her regards and apologizes, she roars. She can't see him, but she no longer hears the creaking of his steps in the snow. He's stopped. Elsa isn't thinking. She rushes into the darkness, relying on pure instinct, towards the spot where she last heard him put down his foot. She feels the movement of air from his jacket. He starts running. She stumbles through the snow and catapults herself forward, catching hold of his trouser leg. When she lands on her back in the snow, she sees him staring down at her by the light of the last streetlight. Elsa has time to feel her tears freezing on her cheeks. He must be a good deal more than 2 meters tall, as big as a tree. There's a thick hood covering his head, and his black hair spills out over his shoulders. Almost his entire face is buried under a beard as thick as an animal pelt, and emerging from the shadows of the hood, a scar zigzags down over one eye, so pronounced that it looks as if the skin has melted. Elsa feels his gaze creeping through her circulating blood.
Let go!
The dark mass of his torso sinks over Elsa as he hisses these words at her.
My granny sends her regards and apologizes!
Elsa pants, holding up the envelope. The monster doesn't take it. She lets go of his trouser leg because she thinks he'll kick her, but he only takes a half step back. And what comes out of him next is more of a growl than a word, as if he's talking to himself, not to her.
Get lost, stupid girl.
The words pulsate against Elsa's eardrums. They sound wrong somehow. Elsa understands them, but they chafe at the passages of her inner ear, as if they didn't belong there. The monster turns with a quick, hostile movement. In the next moment, he's gone, as if he stepped right through a doorway in the darkness. Elsa lies in the snow, trying to catch her breath while the cold stamps on her chest. Then she stands up and gathers her strength, crumpling the envelope into a ball and flinging it into the darkness after him. She doesn't know how many eternities pass before she hears the entrance porch opening behind her. Then she hears Mum's footsteps, hears her calling Elsa's name. Elsa rushes blindly into her arms.
What are you doing out here? Asks Mum, scared.
Elsa doesn't answer. Tenderly, Mum takes her face in her hands.
How did you get that black eye?
Football, whispers Elsa. You're lying, whispers Mum. Elsa nods. Mum holds her hard. Elsa sobs against her stomach.
I miss her.
Mum leans down and puts her forehead against hers. Me too. They don't hear the monster moving out there. They don't see him picking up the envelope. But then at last, burrowing into her mum's arms, Elsa realizes why his words sounded wrong. The monster was talking in Granny and Elsa's secret language. It's possible to love your grandmother for years and years without really knowing anything about her. Chapter 8. Rubber. It's Wednesday. She's running again. She doesn't know the exact reason this time. Maybe it's because it's one of the last days before the Christmas holidays, and they know they won't be able to chase anyone for several weeks now, so they have to get it out of their system. Or maybe it's something else altogether. It doesn't matter. People who have never been hunted always seem to think there's a reason for it. They wouldn't do it without a cause, would they? You must have done something to provoke them. As if that was how oppression works. But it's pointless trying to explain to these people, as fruitless as clarifying to a guy carrying round a rabbit's foot, because of its supposed good luck, that if rabbit's feet really were lucky, they'd still be attached to the rabbits. And this is really no one's fault. It's not that Dad was a bit late picking her up. It's just that the school day finished slightly too early. And it's difficult making oneself invisible when the hunt starts inside the school building. So Elsa runs.
Catch her!
Yells the girl somewhere behind her. Today it all started with Elsa's scarf, or at least Elsa thinks it did. She has started learning who the chasers are at school and how they operate. Some only chase children if they prove to be weak, and some chase just for the thrill of it. They don't even hit their victims when they catch them, just want to see the terror in their eyes. And then there are some like the boy Elsa fought about the right to be Spider-Man. He fights and chases people as a point of principle because he can't stand anyone disagreeing with him, especially not someone who's different. With this girl, it's something else. She wants a reason for giving chase, a way of justifying the chase. She wants to feel like a hero while she's chasing me, thinks Elsa, with unfeasibly cool clarity as she charges towards the fence, her heart thumping like a jackhammer and her throat burning like that time Granny made jalapeno smoothies. Elsa throws herself at the fence, and her backpack lands so hard on her head when she jumps down on the pavement on the other side that for a few seconds her eyes start to black out. She pulls hard on the straps with both hands to tighten it against her back. Hazily she blinks and looks left towards the parking area where Audi should show up at any moment. She hears the girl behind her screaming like an insulted, ravenous orc. She knows that by the time Audi arrives it'll be too late, so she looks right instead down the hill towards the big road. The lorries are thundering by like an invading army on its way towards a castle still held by the enemy. But in the gaps between the traffic, Elsa sees the entrance to the park on the other side. Shoot-up park, that's what people call it at school, because there are drug addicts there who chase children with heroin syringes. At least that's what Elsa's heard, and it terrifies her. It's the sort of park that never seems to catch any daylight, and this is the kind of winter's day when the sun never seems to rise. Elsa had managed just fine until lunchtime, but not even someone who's very good at being invisible can quite manage it in a lunch canteen. The girl had materialized before her so suddenly that Elsa was startled and spilled salad dressing on her Gryffindor scarf. The girl had pointed at it and roared,
"Didn't I tell you to stop going round with that ugly bloody scarf?"
Elsa had looked back at the girl in the only way one can look back at someone who has just pointed at a Gryffindor scarf and said,
"Ugly bloody scarf."
Not totally dissimilar to how one would look at someone who had just seen a horse and gaily burst out,
"Crocodile!"
The first time the scarf caught the girl's attention, Elsa had simply assumed that the girl was a Slytherin. Only after she'd smacked Elsa in the face, ripped her scarf and thrown it in a toilet, had Elsa grown conscious of the fact that the girl hadn't read Harry Potter at all. She knew who he was, of course, everyone knows who Harry Potter is, but she hadn't read the books. She didn't even understand the most basic symbolism of a Gryffindor scarf. And while Elsa didn't want to be elitist or anything, how could one be expected to reason with a person like that? Muggles. So today, when the girl in the lunch canteen had reached out to snatch away Elsa's scarf, Elsa decided to continue the discussion on the girl's own intellectual level. She simply threw her glass of milk at her and ran for it. Through the corridors, up to the second floor of the school, then the third, where there was a space under the stairs that the cleaners used as a storage cupboard. Elsa had curled up in there with her arms round her knees, making herself as invisible as possible while she listened to the girl and her followers run up to the fourth floor. And then she hid in the classroom for the rest of the day. It's the distance between the classroom and the school gates that's impossible. Even a seasoned expert can't be invisible there. So Elsa had to be strategic. First, she stayed close to the teacher while her classmates were crowding to get out of the classroom. Then she slipped out of the door in the general tumult and darted down the other flight of stairs, the one that does not lead to the main gates. Of course, her pursuers knew she'd do that. They may even have wanted her to do it, because she'd be easier to catch on those stairs. But the lesson had finished early, and Elsa took a chance that lessons on the floor below were still in progress. So she had perhaps half a minute to run down the stairs and through the empty corridor and establish a small head start while her pursuers got entangled with the pupils welling out of the classrooms below. She was right. She saw the girl and her friends no more than 10 meters behind her, but they couldn't reach her. Granny has told her thousands of stories from Miamis about pursuit and war, about evading shadows when they're on your tail, how to lay traps for them, and how to beat them with distraction. Like all hunters, shadows have one really significant weakness. They focus all their attention on the one they're pursuing, rather than seeing their entire surroundings. The one being chased, on the other hand, devotes every scrap of attention to finding an escape route. It may not be a gigantic advantage, but it is an advantage. Elsa knows this because she's checked what distraction means. So she shoved her hand into her jeans pocket and got out a handful of coins she kept in her pocket for emergencies. Just as the throng of children was starting to disperse, and she was getting close to the second stair towards the main entrance, she dropped the coins on the floor and ran. Elsa has noticed one odd thing about people. Almost none of us can hear the tinkling sound of coins against a stone floor without instinctively stopping and looking down. The sudden crush and eager arms blocked her pursuers and gave her another few seconds to get clear of them. She made full use of the moment and bolted. but she hears them throwing themselves at the fence now. Trendy winter boots scraping against the buckled steel wire. Just a few more moments until they catch her. Elsa looks left, towards the parking area. No Audi. Looks right, down at the chaos of the road and the black silence of the park. She looks left again, thinks to herself that this would be the safe option if Dad turned up on time for once. Then she looks right, feels an abrasive fear in her gut when she glimpses the park between the roaring lorries. And then she thinks about Granny's stories from Miamis, about how one of the princes once evaded a whole flock of pursuing shadows by riding into the darkest forest in the land of Almost Awake. Shadows are the foulest foulnesses ever to live in any fantasy. But even shadows feel fear, said Granny. Even those bastards are afraid of something, because even shadows have a sense of imagination.
So sometimes the safest place is when you flee to what seems the most dangerous, said Granny.
And then she described how the prince rode right into the darkest forest, and the shadows stopped, hissing at the edge. For not even they were sure what might be lurking inside, on the other side of the trees, and nothing scares anyone more than the unknown, which can only be known by reliance on the imagination.
When it comes to terror, reality's got nothing on the power of the imagination, Granny said.
So Elsa runs to the right. She can smell the burning rubber when the cars break on the ice. That's how Renault smells almost all the time. She darts between the lorries and hears their blaring horns and her pursuers screaming at her. She's reached the pavement when she feels the first of them grab her backpack. She's so near the park that she could reach into the darkness with her hand, but it's too late. By the time she's being pulled down into the snow, Elsa knows that the blows and kicks will rain down on her quicker than her hands can shield her. But she pulls up her knees and closes her eyes and tries to cover her face so Mum won't be upset again. She waits for the dull thuds against the back of her head. Often it doesn't hurt when they hit her. Usually it doesn't hurt until the day after. The pain she feels during the actual beating is a different kind of pain. But nothing happens. Elsa holds her breath. Nothing. She opens her eyes and there's deafening noise all around her. She can hear them yelling, can hear that they're running. And then she hears the monster's voice. Something is booming out of him like a primeval power.
Never touch her.
Everything echoes. Elsa's eardrums are rattling. The monster is not roaring in Granny and Elsa's secret language, but in normal language. The words sound strange in his mouth, as if the intonation of every syllable slips and ends up wrong, as if he hasn't spoken such words for a very long time. Elsa looks up. The monster stares down at her through the shadow of the upturned hood and that beard, which never seems to end. His chest heaves a few times. Elsa hunches up instinctively, terrified that his huge hands are going to grab her and toss her into the traffic like a giant flicking a mouse with a single finger. But he just stands there, breathing heavily and looking angry and confused. At last, he raises his hand as if it's a heavy mallet and points back at the school. When Elsa turns round, she sees the girl who doesn't read Harry Potter and her friends, scattering like bits of paper thrown into the wind. In the distance, she sees Audi turning into the parking area. Elsa takes a deep breath and feels air entering her lungs for what seems like the first time in several minutes. When she turns round again, the monster has gone. Chapter 9. Soap. There are thousands of stories in the real world, but every single one of them is from the land of Almost Awake, and the very best are from Miamis. All six of the kingdoms have produced the odd fairy tale now and then, of course, but none of them are anywhere near as good. In Miamis, fairy tales are still produced round the clock, lovingly handmade one by one, and only the very, very finest of them are exported. Most are only told once, and then they fall flat on the ground, but the best and most beautiful of them rise from the lips of their tellers after the last words have been spoken, and then slowly hover off over the heads of the listeners like small shimmering paper lanterns. When night comes, they are fetched by the enfants. The enfants are very small creatures with decorous hats that ride on cloud animals, the enfants, not the hats. The lanterns are gathered up by the enfants with the help of large golden nets, and then the cloud animals turn and rise up towards the sky so swiftly that even the wind has to get out of the way. And if the wind doesn't move out of the way quickly enough, the clouds transform themselves into an animal that has fingers so the cloud animals can give the finger to the wind. Granny always bellowed with laughter at this. It was a while before Elsa worked out why. And at the peak of the highest mountain in the land of Almost Awake, known as the Telling Mountain, the enfants open their nets and let the stories fly free. And that is how the stories find their way into the real world. At first, when Elsa's granny started telling her stories from Miamis, they only seemed like disconnected fairy tales without a context, told by someone who needed her head examined. It took years before Elsa understood that they belonged together. All really good stories work like this. Granny told her about the lamentable curse of the sea angel and about the two princelings who waged war on each other because they were both in love with the princess of Miplorus. She also talked about the princess engaged in a fight with a witch who had stolen the most valuable treasure in the land of Almost Awake from her. And she described the warriors of Mibatalos and the dancers of Mimovas and the dream hunters of Miravus. How they all constantly bickered and nagged at each other about this or that, until the day the chosen one from Mimovas fled the shadows that had tried to kidnap him. And how the cloud animals carried the chosen one to Miamis, and how the inhabitants of the land of Almost Awake eventually realized that there was something more important to fight for. When the shadows amassed their army and came to take the chosen one by force, they stood united against them. Not even when the war without end seemed unlikely to end in any other way than crushing defeat, not even when the kingdom of Mibatalos fell and was leveled with the ground, did the other kingdoms capitulate, because they knew that if the shadows were allowed to take the chosen one, it would kill all music, and then the power of the imagination in the land of Almost Awake. After that, there would no longer be anything left that was different. All fairy stories take their life from the fact of being different.
Only different people change the world, Granny used to say. No one normal has ever changed a crapping thing.
And then she used to talk about the Wursas. And Elsa should have understood this from the beginning. She really should have understood everything from the beginning. Dad turns off the stereo just before she jumps into Audi. Elsa is glad that he does, because Dad always looks very downhearted when she points out to him that he listens to the worst music in the world, and it's very difficult not pointing it out to him when you have to sit in Audi and listen to the worst music in the world. The belt? Dad asks, as she takes a seat. Elsa's heart is still thumping in her chest.
Well, hi there, you old hyena,
she yells at Dad, because that's what she would have yelled if Granny had picked her up, and Granny would have bellowed back,
hello, hello, my beauty,
and then everything would have felt better. Because you can still feel scared while you're yelling,
well, hi there, you old hyena,
to someone, but it's almost insane how much more difficult it is. Dad looks unsure about it. Elsa sighs and straps herself in and tries to slow her pulse by thinking about things she isn't afraid of. Dad looks even more hesitant.
Your mum and George are at the hospital again.
I know, says Elsa, as you do when something has not succeeded in allaying one's fears. Dad nods. Elsa throws her backpack between the seats and it lands lying across the back seat. Dad turns round and straightens it up very neatly.
You want to do something?
He says, sounding slightly anxious when he says something. Elsa shrugs.
We can do something fun?
Elsa knows he's only offering to be nice, because he has a bad conscience about seeing her so seldom, and because he pities Elsa because her granny has died and because this Wednesday thing was rather sudden for him. Elsa knows this because Dad
would never usually suggest doing something fun, because Dad doesn't like having fun. Fun things make Dad nervous. One time when they were on holiday, when Elsa was small, he went with Elsa and Mum to the beach, and then they had so much fun that Dad had to take two anodin and lie down all afternoon for a rest at the hotel.
"He had too much fun at once," said Mum.
"A fun overdose," said Elsa,
and then Mum laughed for a really long time. The strange thing about Dad is that no one brings out the fun in Mum as much as he does. It's as if Mum is always the opposite pole of a battery. No one brings out order and neatness in Mum like Granny, and no one makes her as untidy and whimsical as Dad. Once when Elsa was small, and Mum was talking on the phone with Dad, and Elsa kept asking,
"Is it Dad? Is it Dad? Can I talk to Dad? Where is he?"
Mum finally turned round and sighed dramatically. "No, you can't talk to Dad because Dad is in heaven now, Elsa." And when Elsa went absolutely silent and just stared at her mum, Mum grinned, "Good God, I'm only joking, Elsa. He's at the supermarket." She grinned, just like Granny used to do. The morning after, Elsa came into the kitchen with shiny eyes when Mum was drinking coffee with loads of lactose-free milk. And when Mum, looking worried, asked why Elsa was looking so upset, Elsa replied that she had dreamed that Dad was in heaven. And then Mum went out of her mind with guilt and hugged Elsa hard, hard, hard and said sorry over and over and over again. And then Elsa waited almost 10 minutes before she grinned and said,
"Good God, I was only joking. I dreamed he was at the supermarket."
After that, Mum and Elsa often used to joke with Dad and ask him what it was like in heaven.
"Is it cold in heaven? Can one fly in heaven? Is one allowed to meet God in heaven?" asked Mum. "Do you have cheese graters in heaven?" asked Elsa,
and then they laughed until they couldn't sit straight. Dad used to look really quite hesitant when they did that. Elsa misses it. Misses when Dad was in heaven.
"Is Granny in heaven now?"
she says to him, and grins because she means it as a joke, and she imagines he'll start laughing. But he doesn't laugh, he just looks that way, and Elsa feels ashamed of saying something that makes him look that way.
"Oh, never mind," she mumbles and pats the glove compartment.
"We can go home. It's cool,"
she adds quickly. Dad nods and looks relieved and disappointed. They see the police car from a distance, in the street outside the house, and Elsa can already hear the barking as they're getting out of Audi. The stairs are full of people. Our friend's furious howling from inside its flat is making the whole building shake.
"Do you have a key?" asks Dad.
Elsa nods and gives him a quick hug. Stairwells filled with people make Dad very tentative. He gets back into Audi and Elsa goes inside by herself. And somewhere beyond that ear-splitting noise from our friend, she hears other things too. Voices. Dark, composed, and threatening. They have uniforms and they move about outside the flat where the boy with the syndrome and his mother live. Eyeing our friend's door intently but clearly afraid of getting too close, they press themselves to the wall on the other side. One of the policewomen turns round. Her green eyes meet Elsa's. It's the same policewoman she and Granny met at the station that night Granny threw the turds. She nods morosely at Elsa, as if trying to apologize. Elsa doesn't nod back. She just pushes past and runs. She hears one of the police talking into a telephone, mentioning the words, "animal control," and "to be destroyed." Britt Marie is standing halfway up the stairs, close enough to be able to give the police suggestions about what they should do, but at a safe distance in case the beast manages to get out of the door. She smiles in a well-meaning way at Elsa. Elsa hates her. When she reaches the top floor, our friend starts baying louder than ever, like a hurricane of 10,000 fairy tales. Looking down the shaft between the flights of stairs, Elsa can see that the police are backing away. And Elsa should have understood it all from the beginning. She really should have. There is an absolutely unimaginable number of very special monsters in the forests and mountains of Miamis, but none were more legendary or more deserving of the respect of every creature in Miamis, even Granny, than the worses. They were as big as polar bears, moved as fluidly as desert foxes, and were as quick on the attack as cobras. They were stronger than oxen, with the stamina of wild stallions and jaws more ferocious than tigers. They had a lustrous, black pelt, as soft as a summer wind, but underneath their hide was thick as armour. In the really old fairy tales they were said to be immortal. These were the tales from the elder eternities, when the Wursers lived in Miploris and served the royal family as castle guards. It was the princess of Miploris who banished them from the land of almost awake, Granny used to explain, a sense of guilt lingering in the silences between her words. When the princess was still a child, she'd wanted to play with one of the puppies while it was sleeping. She tugged its tail, and it woke in a panic and bit her hand. Of course, everyone knew that the real blame lay with her parents, who had not taught her never, ever to wake a worse than sleeping. But the princess was so afraid and her parents so angry that they had to put the blame on someone else so they could live with themselves. For this reason, the court decided to banish the worsers from the kingdom forever. They gave a particularly merciless group of bounty-hunting trolls permission to hunt them with poison arrows and fire. Obviously the worsers could have hit back. Not even the assembled armies of the land of Almost Awake would have dared face them in battle. That was how feared the animals were as warriors. But instead of fighting, the worsers turned and ran. They ran so far and so high into the mountains that no one believed they would ever be found again. They ran until the children in the six kingdoms had grown up without seeing a single worse in their entire lives. Ran for so long that they became legendary. It was only with the coming of the War Without End that the princess of Miploris realized her terrible mistake. The shadows had killed all the soldiers in the warrior kingdom of Mibatalos and leveled it with the ground, and now they pressed in with terrific power against the rest of the land of Almost Awake. When all hope seemed lost, the princess herself rode away from the city walls on her white horse. She rode like a storm into the mountains, and there, after an almost endless search that had made her horse succumb to exhaustion and almost crushed her too, the worsers found her. By the time the shadows heard the thunder and felt the ground shaking, it was already too late for them. The princess rode at the front on the greatest of all worse warriors, and that was the moment of Wolfheart's return from the forests. Maybe because Miamis was teetering on the edge of extinction and needed him more than ever. But maybe, Granny used to whisper into Elsa's ear when they sat on the cloud animals at night, maybe most of all because the princess, by realizing how unjust she had been to the worsers, proved that all the kingdoms deserved to be saved. The War Without End ended that day. The shadows were driven across the sea, and Wolfheart disappeared back into the forests. But the worsers remained, and to this day they are still serving as the princess's personal guard in Miploris. On guard, outside her castle gate. Elsa hears our friend barking quite madly down there now. She remembers what Granny said about how making a racket amuses it. Elsa feels a bit unsure about our friend's sense of humour, but then remembers what Granny said about our friend not needing to live with anyone. Granny didn't live with anyone herself, of course, and when Elsa pointed out that perhaps she shouldn't compare herself to a dog, Granny rolled her eyes. Now, Elsa understands why. She should have got all this from the start. She really should have. Because this is no dog. One of the police fumbles with a big bunch of keys. Elsa hears the main door opening downstairs, and between our friend's barks, she hears the boy with the syndrome dancing up the stairs. The police gently shove him and his mother into their flat. Britt Marie minces back and forth with tiny steps on her floor. Elsa hates her through the banisters. Our friend is completely quiet for a moment, as if it has made a strategic retreat for a moment to gather its strength for the real battle. The police jingle the bunch of keys and talk about being ready in case it attacks. They all sound fuller of themselves now because our friend is no longer barking. Elsa hears another door opening. And then she hears Leonard's voice. He asks timidly what's happening.
The police explain that they have come to take charge of a dangerous dog.
Leonard sounds a bit worried. Then he sounds a little like he doesn't know what to say. Then he says what he always says.
Does anyone want a cup of coffee? Maud just made some fresh.
Britt Marie interrupts, hissing at him that surely Leonard can understand that the police have more important things to get on with than drinking coffee. The police sound a little disappointed about this. Elsa sees Leonard going back up the stairs. At first he seems to consider staying on the landing, but then seems to realise this might lead to a situation of his own coffee getting cold and conclude that whatever is going on here, it could not possibly be worth a risk like that. He disappears into the flat. The first bark after that is short and defined, as if our friend is merely testing its vocal cords. The second is so loud that all Elsa can hear for several eternities is a ringing sound in her ears. When it finally ebbs away, she hears a terrific thud, then another, and one more. Only then does she understand what the noise means. Our friend is launching itself with all its strength at the inside of the door. Elsa hears one of the police talking on the telephone again. She can't hear most of what's being said, but she hears the words, "Extremely large and aggressive." She peers down through the railings and sees the police standing a few metres from the door of our friend's flat, their self-confidence dwindling as our friend throws itself at the door with increasing force. Two more police have turned up, Elsa notices. One of them has brought an Alsatian on a leash. The Alsatian doesn't seem to think it's a terrific idea to go wherever that thing, whatever it is trying to get out. It watches its handler, a little like Elsa looked at Granny that time she tried to rewire Mum's microwave. "Call in animal control, then," Elsa hears the policewoman with green eyes saying, at last, with a disconsolate sigh.
"That's what I said, exactly what I said,"
Britt Marie calls out eagerly. The green eyes throw a glance at Britt Marie that causes her to shut up abruptly. Our friend barks one last time, horrifyingly loud, then grows silent again. There's a lot of noise on the stairs for a moment, and then Elsa hears the main entrance door closing. The police have clearly decided to wait further away from whatever is living in that flat until animal control get there. Elsa watches through the window as they make off, something in their body language suggesting coffee. Whereas the Alsatian has something in its body language that suggests it is considering early retirement. Everything is suddenly so quiet on the stairs that Britt Marie's lone tripping steps further down are giving off an echo. Elsa stands there in two minds. She knows that in two minds is a phrase for the word jar. She can see the police through the window, and in retrospect Elsa will not be able to explain exactly why she does it. But no true knight of Miamis could stand and watch a friend of Granny's being killed without trying to do something about it. So she quickly sneaks down the stairs, taking extra care as she passes Britt Marie and Kent's flat, and taking the precaution of stopping on every half-landing to listen and make sure the police are not coming back in. Finally, she stops outside our friend's flat and carefully opens the letterbox. Everything is black in there, but she hears our friend's rumbling breath.
"It's me,"
Elsa stammers. She doesn't know exactly how to start this type of conversation, and our friend doesn't answer. On the other hand, it doesn't throw itself against the door either. Elsa sees this as a clear sign of progress in their communication.
"It's me, the one with the dime bars."
Our friend doesn't answer, but she can hear its breathing slowing down. Elsa's words tumble out of her as if someone had toppled them over.
"Hey, I mean, this might sound mega weird, but I sort of think my granny would have wanted you to get out of here somehow, you know? If you have a back door or something, because otherwise they'll shoot you. Maybe that sounds mega weird, but it's pretty weird that you've got your own flat as well, if you get what I mean."
Only once all the words have fallen out of her does she realise that she's spoken them in the secret language, like a test, because if there's just a dog on the other side of the door, it won't understand.
"But if it does understand," she thinks, "then it's something quite different."
She hears a sound made by a paw the size of a car tyre, quickly scraping the inside of the door.
"Hope you understand,"
Elsa whispers in the secret language. She never hears the door opening behind her. The only thing she has time to register